Hey, Dylan Kelly here, host of the Wave Break podcast. Excited to get into this episode, but first, here's a quick word from our sponsor. This episode of the Wave Break podcast is brought to you by Klaviyo, the growth marketing platform most recommended by other business leaders. Listen, in uncertain times, you need to be supporting your community and growing relationships with your customers. It's going to be appreciated. It's going to be remembered. It's going to be shared. And in good times and bad, this type of communication that's open and empathetic with your customers is key. This is a key theme that we've been talking about at Wavebreak. I've been preaching this on the podcast. And when you're communicating with your customers in this way, the best way to do this is with email. It is and always will be one of the best channels for delivering communication like this. And what I love about Klaviyo is that email is one of its core offerings. And their personalization that you can do inside Klaviyo is just, it can't be beat. And when you leverage that personalization driven by a 360-degree view of the customer, these emails are going to feel more relevant and they're going to drive even stronger relationships. And Klaviyo gets it. They're not just, you know, some company. They understand how challenging it is right now for every entrepreneur. You know, it was hard to get your business off the ground, and navigating these times is even harder. And if you're feeling overwhelmed with growing your business, know that you're not alone. Klaviyo is here to help you build relationships across any distance for your brand and create memorable and meaningful email marketing moments that last a lifetime. And that's how you build a successful e-commerce brand. And this is why I love Klaviyo so much, because they're on the same page with me and Wavebreak. Is like, we're not just about making more revenue. That's great. But what this is really about is an opportunity to create an amazing community with your customers. And the best way to do it is with email. And if you're not on Klaviyo, you gotta get on Klaviyo. Visit klaviyo.com to schedule a free trial. That's Klaviyo.com. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Wavebreak podcast. I'm your host, Dylan Kelly, founder and CEO of Wavebreak. We're an email marketing agency. Now we do email and SMS. We're driving a lot of revenue for our clients. Klaviyo Platinum Partner, doing over $100 million a year for our clients. We've taken companies from, you know, 400K a month to $35 million a year in email revenue. We've taken company from $1 million to, you know, millions of dollars in email revenue. We've scaled SMS as a channel from zero to a seven-figure channel in less than 6 months for brands. We've got seven-figure channels of SMS running for companies with as few as 30,000 subscribers. Extremely powerful channel. And we have some insights and innovative strategies that we use to get even more performance out of SMS than the standard benchmark. And same goes for email. Like, if your email program is stale, you haven't been optimizing it, you know you could be doing better. You're just viewing it as a channel, not you seeing it as, maybe not even the way you look at it, but you're treating it not as the growth lever that it is through email and SMS and the impact it can have. If that's because you're lacking, whether it's strategic expertise or just the team to execute or a mix of both, that's exactly why I started Wavebreak. We come in, we become your email and SMS team, get you going with the best in class program from strategy to copywriting to creative. Everything looks great. You'll look like a top brand because you are a top brand, and we'll help you get even more out of your existing customer base, build that community up, increase engagement, and ultimately drive more revenue and make things easier as, you know, customer acquisition gets more and more expensive. So if you want to learn more about us, we're pretty booked up right now, but get on our calendar as soon as possible so you can get to the top of the wait list. You can learn more at wavebreak.com. And yeah, I'm really excited for this episode. So for this episode, a friend of mine recently asked me, he said, "Hey Dylan, like, what are some of your favorite podcasts you've done?" And I was like, "That's a great question." So I went through, looked through the list. And so today we're replaying an episode that I recorded last year in the middle of a pandemic with Alex Dasmalchi, founder and CEO of Vanity Planet, among, you know, a bunch of other brands. Alex is really awesome because I'll remember from our conversation a few things. Like, one, this is an episode that I personally go back and listen to and I'm just inspired by. I love the way Alex thinks about growth. It's very simple. It's not easy, but it's very simple. It's like, hey, this is working. Let's scale it up. And he does it really quickly, which is really incredible. So that's one of my favorite pieces, not just like, okay, what are the tactics and strategies he uses, but like, how does he look at business and growth in general? And then the other piece too is just like how positive the guy is. One of the most positive people I've ever met in my life. and it's just really great to see. And, you know, they're continuing to do really well. And there's a lot to learn from this episode, and sent it to my friend. And he said, hey, yeah, this is an amazing episode. So wanted to replay it on the podcast this week. It's a great one, whether you've heard it before or haven't. If you haven't, you definitely have to listen to it. And if you did listen to it again and listen to it in a new light with the current stage of business that you're in. You'll learn something new. It's a really great episode. And we've got some exciting things planned for the podcast in the future too. So stay tuned. Actually, the biggest move the podcast has had to date. So yeah, stay tuned for that. It'll be rolling out in the next few weeks. So really, really excited to get that out to you guys. But in the meantime, enjoy this episode with Alex Desmalchi, founder and CEO of Vanity Planet. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Alex.
It's great to be with you guys. Hi, everyone.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I'm really excited today to talk about scaling fast, the current e-commerce environment, your thoughts on it. But before we get into all that good stuff, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself, the brands you run, and your background?
Yeah, of course. So my name is Alex Desmalchi, difficult last name, but it's spelled, it's pronounced just like it's spelled. I'm from Iran. I was born and raised there, left at the age of 16, migrated over to the US, and I've been self-employed since the age of 18. I tell people I'm unemployable. I got fired and I said, what the heck, I'll just go work for myself. And finished school at night, and it's been a really fun journey. The company that I run today, that I'm a CEO of, Desmalchi LLC, we own a portfolio of consumer product goods, as you'd mentioned, Dylan. Our top performing one is Vanity Planet. We started about 8 years ago. It took us the first year to figure out what exactly we were going to do, and obviously at the very beginning, it was a challenge, especially because we were coming off of that great recession. So with very little capital, we had to, or none, actually, we had to figure out how do we get into this exciting business that we're in today.
Yeah. And like, what is like Vanity Planet? For those who don't know, like, what do you sell? What space are you in? What does that look like?
Yeah, sure. So Vanity Planet, we're in the beauty business. We're in beauty devices. We have the most comprehensive of skincare devices that are out there. We look at beauty from head to toe. We don't think that it's limited to just your face. We've had hair tools from time to time, and we're working on a few more exciting ones that are about to come out. But for the most part, we're a device company. We recently, in 2019 and the later part of 2018, we launched some consumables as well to match up with our products. So we're all about performance parity. So we invest a ton of time in our products. We start with, we would never sell anything that we don't love and we don't use ourselves here at the office and our loved ones. Then we want to make sure that we deliver those products at an incredible value. So a spa-like experience that you pay a lot of money for, but being able to buy those devices and use them in your home and at your leisure, that's been our goal since day one, at an incredible value, and we're delivering on it.
Yeah, that's awesome. How did you get into this space? Do you have a background in beauty, or what made you choose like this space to get into?
Yeah, I actually, when I was younger and I first migrated here, I think I was like in my, say 18, 19, and I had cystic acne. It was really bad. And I went to a doctor, and I think I spent like 2 months of my paycheck. And I had multiple jobs in trying to address my acne, and I realized how expensive it is. And we were looking for a business about 8 years ago to explore and get into. And I always had a passion for trying to figure out a solution for a problem. And the problem was that skincare, and if you wanted to get something done, for the most part, if you didn't go to a professional and paid a ton of money for it, you couldn't afford it. So we wanted to break into that market and revolutionize it and turn it upside down. And it started with that, and it took a lot of due diligence and work and identifying products, bringing them in, testing it, traveling. And we were fortunate that we realized that there was a lot of inefficiencies in the system. This is before the whole digitally vertical native brand existed, we realized that if you go directly to the source and cut out all the middle people and also make the system very efficient, where we don't have a large footprint, we could pass along all of those savings to our customers. And that's what we've been able to do. So it's a lot of fun to see that in play.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, you're definitely a pioneer in it with when you guys started. And like jumping more into the growth side of things, I mean, you guys grew pretty fast once you started to figure it out. Like, is there any numbers that you can share as far as like the size of the business is now, or any kind of metrics you can share on where Vanity Planet is at?
Yeah, yeah. So the very first order that we placed was, it was for an electric toothbrush, actually. It wasn't even Vanity Planet. And we didn't have the capital. It was, I think, $55,000 order that we put on credit cards and borrowed a little money from friends and family. And we launched. So we started off with those and we celebrated literally our first one or two sales. And once we got that going and created a little bit of momentum, I traveled to Asia and looked at some skincare devices and started bringing those in. So the first couple of years of the business, you asked a really good question, was a lot of fun. It was very challenging, and it was about making those first few sales, and then it just spun out of control where orders were coming in, and as soon as we would bring products in, they would sell out. We were a really small team. We were a team of six people, including myself. And as that grew and we were profitable and having fun, but then as businesses grow, then you need a much better infrastructure, and you need to make sure that the team is also constantly investing in themselves and growing with the company. So there were different milestones that we hit, and I think every business is different. For us, the first milestone was from 0 to 4 million. That was fun, and we were able to manage everything on Excel sheets and still keep the team small. When we hit the 4 million mark, it got a little out of control using Excel sheets. It was that 4 to 5 million that we had to look into an ERP system and start bringing people in on the finance side. And we started with a senior accountant and had to figure out logistics. And as you add more SKU counts, your business starts getting more and more complex. So you're adding to your cost and you're adding to your complexity. And with the infrastructure improvements that we made, it allowed us to go from 5 to 10, 12 million. And then we needed to do another upgrade that took us to the mid 20 million range. And that was a lot of fun. And then we went from the mid 20, we grew 1 year, 52% year over year. And that broke our systems and in some cases, our people and our processes that we had. And we had to restructure again. So it's been really interesting understanding what those, what that graph looks like to you, your company, your people. And we've been able to challenge ourselves and challenge our systems and see what we need to get done and improve. And the traffic coming in, again, complexity grows and SKU count going up. But I can't share with you exactly what the numbers are that we're doing, but it's definitely been fun. And I tell you that the milestones that we hit were 5 million, roughly, let's say 10 million, the mid 20 million, and then getting closer to 40 million.
Yeah, that's awesome. I want to dive into the just like the operations side of scaling. But before we dive into that, I want to talk about the marketing side. Like, I mean, that was the thing about those milestones too, is that they happen really close together, right?
They do. They do. And in fact, we'll dig into marketing, but in fact, 2018 was a really interesting year for us. We grew too much and then started realizing by the time we wrapped up the year we took, it was a really good year. It was our banner year, but the following year that turned into an actual loss, because our cost structures had gone up and we weren't as efficient as when we had started the business. So we kind of took most of 2019 from Q2 all the way to Q4 into retweaking and rebuilding our infrastructure and our team.
Yeah, that's I mean, that's wild. And I'm excited to unpack that. So marketing side, like, how did you fuel the marketing side of things to enable growth that big? Like, you mentioned you would keep launching these brand new products, and then your problem wasn't selling them, but it was like, crap, we can't keep enough of these things. Like, we just keep tearing through them. Like, what was the marketing strategy to drive those sales?
Yeah, again, from the beginning, making sure that you have a product that you know people would love. I think what's really exciting about the times that we live in is the transparency. You can't just, like, you know, in the past, everybody sold stuff on television and they promised you. I remember I was a kid and I got a toy and I was so excited to get it. I saw the commercial. It was amazing. This car would jump and flip and do all sorts of stuff. When I got the product, it definitely wasn't that. So I learned that a lot of advertising at that time was really deceptive. But in today's world, we live in a very transparent world. So my experience sharing to everyone who's listening would be, you have to start with a product that is, that you truly believe in and that you're passionate about. From there, it's all about getting the word out and how do you get people to come in and take a look at your products and consider them. We kind of, in marketing, have always had the philosophy that everything is worth a try. The Pareto rule, the 80-20, if you will. If you start with something that's simple, that if I bring 5 products in, my hope is that one of them will take off. If I bring 10 products in, my hope is that 2 of them will be accepted. And it does usually work out to be the exact same math. We spent a lot of time ahead of time doing testings ourselves. So our numbers were significantly better, which was exciting. But we did have some failures. We did bring some products in that we were excited about, and they just simply didn't work. They were a pretty small percentage of the SKUs that we onboarded. For marketing itself, we tried everything and anything. When we first started, we were with Groupon, and they were first starting, which was really exciting. And we quickly realized that we don't want to be a one-trick pony. We don't want to just rely on one customer. If the business model changes, that we will that it will significantly impact us. And in fact, there was a reason for our failure in the late, I think it was 2009, 2010. And had a policy that nothing should drive more than 20% of our revenue or be responsible for 20% of our business. So Groupon being the first one, we were trying to see what else could we do. We went to other .coms and Amazon and all the other flash sales sites, daily deal sites, grew the business there. And the passion was always, how do we connect directly with that consumer? How do we tell them? Again, remember, our business model has always been on efficiency. When you want to be efficient, you want to be as direct to the customer as possible. We tried a bunch of paid digital ads, and they did okay, nothing that exciting. And I think, what did they say, only a fool doesn't listen. We were in one of our meetings, and at that time, we had 8 people working at the office, and one of our really bright young girls, Natalie, who's still with us. She was really young at the time. I think she was 19. She mentioned YouTube, and she's like, why don't we start selling on YouTube? The term influencer wasn't used, although influencer marketing has always been around. Michael Jordan and, you know, all the other ones that, you know, Nike built their entire empire based on that. We kind of like dug in and asked her a few more questions. And she's like, I follow these beauticians and they make recommendations on products. And I usually pull the trigger and buy them. So we tested out a couple of YouTube promos with some influencers. We identified a few on Google and doing manual searches, found them and realized that that was delivering a better result for us. It was getting us closer to what we wanted to do. Zip forward. Most of our traffic comes from influencers. In fact, we pride ourselves in having, I believe, 10,000 plus, maybe a little over that now, of influencers that we've actually been able to partner up with to date. These are macro and mega influencers, and the nano and micro influencers were also starting to become way more active. And all these relationships we've maintained for years, and then the term influencer marketing came about, and we were getting direct hits to our website, and the whole digitally vertical native brand term started popping up. But we were at the very beginning of it, and then it became very competitive because everyone else wanted to jump in. But we stayed very true again to our core philosophy, and we were able to deliver for our influencer partners, which just turned into some meaningful relationships for us and has allowed us to continue to do that despite the fact that it's a very competitive marketplace now.
Yeah, no, so many good things to unpack there. I love the idea of that like 20% rule, just because like that is kind of when you get in that like risky territory, like you lose one channel, you know, especially in the age of like Facebook and Google, it's like you're almost giving control to Silicon Valley instead of like in your own hands. Like what, how do you balance that kind of idea, like that 20% rule, with, you know, scaling, like putting your foot on the gas? Cause like going from 0 to 10,000 influencers, like that's a lot. Like, did you balance that, or what was kind of like the idea behind, like behind that? Is it something you'd figured out later, or what did that look like?
Yeah. So the 20-80 rule that I'd mentioned to you was with products, but again, it applies everywhere. So same thing with marketing. You try 10 different marketing mediums and you hope that one of them would work, or maybe even two. And if one or two of them actually work and they're sustainable and you could grow it, you could turn up the notch, the volume, it'll make up for the losses that you've had. I believe that a lot of marketers get stuck in doing so much or being too conservative in their model building that they'll forget about testing. And to me, testing is exactly when you have that R&D money. That's your play money. And you'll test out 10 marketing things on a smaller scale and for everyone that looks different, right? And you'll see which one works. And once it does, you'll see how much can you scale it. For us, influencer marketing, we realized that it's a very scalable model. So we went from testing two videos to growing that team to 18 people in less than a year.
Wow. What is your methodology for that? Because I know so many people listening to this podcast, it's like they tested all these channels, they see some success, you know, and they're getting this these positive returns. But like, there's kind of like, you know, they're not doubling down on it in the sense where they're going to go and build out a team of 18 in the next year. Like, what's your mindset look like when you're thinking about scaling up marketing after you find a winner?
After you find a winner, I think you need to look at how big is that market. So for us with influencer marketing, we looked at how big was the market at the current time. And then you'll look at the future and try and guesstimate as best as you can. Does this market have the opportunity to grow? And obviously, everyone knows this, that influencers were, there were more influencers on a daily basis coming out than anything else. So, and the customers were loving it and they were reacting to it and they were appreciating it. That has changed and we all know that too. I think number one is it is much tougher for an influencer to become to broaden their reach and to grow their following. It is a business and it's a very difficult business. It's not as easy. I think the ones that started it off and, you know, were looking for that 15 minute of fame, that's exactly what they got. That there were some influencers that were really smart and treated it like a business and they were able to grow it. And those, the ones that grew also were the ones that always put their fans in front of everyone else or anything else. They put their fans in front of monetary compensation. And they never promote a product that they don't think will add value to their customers or they don't believe in. It comes to transparency side. So there are a lot of different factors that you've got to look at. Again, unfortunately, influencer marketing, anything that becomes super hot and everybody is after supply and demand, right? So prices go up. I don't know of anybody who's done well with influencer marketing over the past recent couple of years. It's become more and more difficult. But we stayed again, I think, and every business should understand what their principles are, what are they willing to do, and stay true to that. And we did. We never adhered to paying those high rates, and we made it a win-win instead of just one person winning, the brand winning, or just influencer winning, or just the customers winning. I think when you're looking at creating a perfect formula, you want to look for wins all the way around. It has to be just, and it's got to be fun and fair to everybody involved. And listen, influencers realized that there would be big brands that would come in and pay them $100,000 for an appearance or a series of posts, and then they would go away. But we worked with them year in, year out. There's a lot of value when you're consistent with your partners.
Got it. So even in these challenging times when, like, yeah, you know, influencer marketing these last few years, like, it's not what it was at its peak, you know, years ago, or maybe it's like, that's, maybe it's still peaking now, right? For the brands who know how to do it. Like, so you're saying, like, you've switched up the strategy to where you're now focused on, or you've always been focused on, like, building these win-win relationships instead of just like, hey, we pay you for a post, you post, the end, goodbye. So you're still running influencer stuff now?
100%, we are. Our ROAS, our return on ad spend, is significantly shrunk. So then you have to couple it with, you know, you're looking for your LTV, right? So you have to couple it with all the other touches to that traffic that comes in and hope that you can retarget and bring the customers that are purchasing from you, that few small percentage points that are buying from you, to make them fall in love with your brand and your product and to come back and make more purchases. Eventually, I think the best marketing is when people tell their friends and family about the product or the service that you're offering. But plus data, I think, you know, a lot of people maybe undervalue data, and we've been very, very good at it. And we've had a lot of discipline where we take a look at traffic that is coming in from every single post that goes out there. And there has been months that we've done 600-700 posts with, again, very large influencers and brought in a few million of unique visitors to the sites. But the data, we still measure every post from the minute that it goes up, how much traffic did they bring in, what was the value of each click, what was this. You know, we look at how many people viewed a story, for instance, on Instagram. Then we look at how many clicks was generated. So we look at every single funnel all the way to the close, and we put a value on that. And so we know every one of our posts, every one of our influencers, and in aggregate, the total department, how much money did we deploy and how much did we bring back in and how many customers did we activate.
Wow. And how do you track that? Because I know for a lot of brands, it's really hard for them to spend money and then track the sales back directly to influencer stuff, especially like if you're doing some like Instagram stuff. Like, how are you capturing that data?
So at the beginning, again, it was like Excel sheets, nothing existed. And thankfully, we live in a world that there are a lot of great platforms out there. They allow you to, even before you work with an influencer, there are platforms that would give you data on the demographics and the performance scorecard, if you will, for every influencer. And you'll be able to measure more accurately. I think just looking at an influencer saying, oh, great, this person has 500,000 followers. Well, what's their engagement rate like? What percentage of their audience lives, if you're doing D2C in the US, we're now shipping globally, but if you're in the US, their only customers that matter to you are here in the US. We look at metrics like an audience, the demographic of an influencer, what percentage of them speaks English, because we don't offer multilingual websites. What percentage of them live in the U.S. And based on a lot of the historical data that we have, we're also relying very heavily on that. It gives us a pretty good indication of what to expect from every post that goes up. So we know going in what the value of what the influencer wants and what we can pay, what that is. And it'll make life a lot easier because there could be such a huge delta. Or in a lot of instances where we do explain how we drive, how we come up with that value, and what are the things that we're looking at, and we share it back with our influencer partners, they do understand, and they're supportive of it.
Got it. Did you build that software internally, or is that something public that anyone can use?
Yeah, no, I wish there was something that anyone could use. It would make my life a lot easier. We're not a tech company, but there is not one perfect tool out there. There are some that are a lot better than the others, but there is not one perfect tool out there. It's a combination. We probably are combining data from 10 to 12 different data sources. Oh, and wow. Then we are able to bring all of those together and look at them and make a decision.
Got it. So you're basically taking all the data that's out there and then looking at that. It's not like one specific platform.
No, it's not, because a lot of the influence and the decision is coming in from our historical sales data.
Oh,
and again, it's
I see.
Very different. So ultimately, that's what drives the value. But it's very different. If you're in a business of selling water bottles, your conversions or your brand and your brand affinity could be really different than ours. You might do a heck of a lot better than we do. So it really depends. It's very specific to every business and the product that they're offering.
Got it. No, that makes sense. And yeah, that's super helpful. I know we're starting to run out of time here, but just like quickly touching on the operations side, like when you were scaling the business that fast, from milestone to milestone, like looking back, like if there's one kind of piece of advice that you would give yourself looking back, through those fast growing times, like to think about the operations side of keeping everything moving, like what would that piece of advice be?
Great question. And I could talk about this for a very long time. I think, at least for us, and I can't say that this is true for everybody, but when you're growing really quickly, it's really rewarding. It's a lot of fun. There's a lot of excitement. And I personally believe that success makes you lazy. And what we did is, as we grew, we started growing out of control, and we got excited about, okay, well, we need more people. We need this person to do this. We need that person to do X. And then we need this director, that director. And we started focusing more on growth than profitability. Now, we all know this, right? Up until recently, companies were being only valued on their growth and how much can you grow and how fast you can grow. And we've all heard those crazy stories that that private equity firms and VC money, they're looking for 300-500% growth year over year, some ridiculous numbers. We also got caught into that whole thing, that excitement, and grew our team quite a bit. We have a really lean and mean team right now. We're just under 40, and we outsource a bit of stuff. And again, we ship to 100 countries a month, although most of it is US, Canada, UK, Australia, and then it trickles down into Europe. But we got excited about that and overhired. And when you overhire, that's just one of the levers that you got to look at. When you overhire, then there's that law of diminishing output. Then politics starts coming in. You're building layer over layer. There's a little great YouTube video. The name of it skips my mind, but it's talking about, it's really simple math. It's talking about the law of diminishing output, where if you have one pizza oven and you hire your second chef, then you're seeing great results. Hire the third, not so much. By the time you hire your fourth chef, if you only have one pizza oven, you've actually now in the negative territories because people are overstepping each other. So I think if I were to talk to anyone, I believe that those times of just top line growth, are those days are over. The financial market, everyone is looking for companies that are delivering profit. And there is a significant appetite for that. Now, it will be much, much larger in the future. So having a discipline around finances and staying profitable, I think it's the most important thing. No matter what, if you have a business that is not making money and you try and pretty it up and you have all of these complex reports and beautiful pitch deck, at the end of the day, you're trying to put the kind of pig. But if you're making money, first of all, your sustainability is insured. Plus, if you ever want to do an exit, your future is guaranteed as well. So discipline, discipline, discipline. That's exactly where you want to go. And having matrix and data and fully looking at them often, just saying something, setting it up, forgetting it. Our biggest reason for success the years that we've been has always been around setting matrix and numbers for every single person on our team and measuring it throughout, not just on a monthly or quarterly basis. We look at run rates, projections, and it's not just revenue, but our customer support team, with the reviews that we get on our products. Everything is measured.
Wow. There's so much to unpack here. Like, we could really keep talking for hours, but I love it. I feel like a lot of us get in this, especially, you know, as entrepreneurs, it's easy, and especially during times of growth, to look at process problems and like to solve them with people, because it's like easy, you know. But then it'll always come back to bite you later.
But it does start with people. You're right.
It does.
And you have to have the right people on the team. And that was always a very difficult challenge too, right? With the employment market, unemployment being so low, which was awesome. But bringing in the right team, finding the right talent for your company was becoming really, really difficult. I believe now that's changed a little bit, and unfortunately it's going to change more. But you have access to really great talent. And then bringing them in, making sure that the expectations are defined, articulated, communicated, and having a measuring process in place. Those are as simple as they may sound, but those are, and when it comes to the work, it's actually harder than it sounds.
Yeah, for sure. But I think so many, I mean, even just that little snippet alone, like people just setting clear expectations for every role, like so many businesses lack that. And it's like you wonder why people aren't doing what you expect of them. And it's just because they don't know what you expect of them. And by telling people how to win in their role and then measuring it, it's like you have no excuses for it. I love that.
That's so true.
That's awesome. Well, hey, we're running out of time here. I wish we had another hour or two to keep talking. We might have to have you on again sometime. But really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show, Alex. As we wrap up here, where can people go to learn more about you, your company, Vanity Planet, and all the stuff you have going on?
Yeah, on our website, dastmalchi.com, dastmalchi.com has all of our brands. And then Vanity Planet, you can just directly go to vanityplanet.com. I also really do appreciate the opportunity. I do wish that we had more time. And for everyone that's listening, I do wish everyone the best. And it's been great chatting with you, and I'm honored, and thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show, Alex, and thanks everybody for listening.
All right, Dylan, thank you.
Now, listener, before I sign off, stop me if this sounds familiar. Your email marketing is stuck. You feel like you could be doing email better. You're not generating enough email revenue, and you feel like you're leaving money on the table. But you don't have the time to figure email out yourself or do it on your own because you have a business to run. Imagine this. Imagine not having to worry about leaving money on the table with your email marketing. Imagine not having to figure out what to send, when to send it, how many emails should look, what automation you need, what segments you need, how often you should be contacting your email list, or just worrying about sending the next email. You don't have to worry about any of that. Imagine having peace of mind knowing that your email marketing is generating sales in good hands. At Wavebreak, we help Shopify stores maximize their email marketing revenue. That's it. We don't do anything else. And we've created a system called the Wavebreak Method that, number one, makes you less dependent on Facebook or other marketing channels. So let's say something bad happens. Facebook says, see you later, Shopify store, and they just completely kill your ad traffic overnight. You don't have to worry. You don't have to stress because you're good to go because you have a cushion of email revenue. You don't have to worry about how or what your wife is going to do or if you're going to be able to make rent or if you're going to be able to pay people because you have this cushion of email revenue to rely on. Number two, the second thing this does is huge, and it's how stores scale from 7 figures to 8 figures to 9 figures. And the secret is repeat purchases. The Wavebreak method gets rid of one-time buyers and increases repeat orders. Number three, it keeps your email list engaged. You don't have to worry about Black Friday and beyond. We'll figure out the ideal amount of times that your list needs to be contacted to maximize revenue, and then we'll execute it for you. If you want to learn more about this system and how we can work together to apply it to your business, go to wavebreak.co to schedule a call with me. And I'll personally send you my calendar link and we can chat one-on-one. Now, I don't have unlimited time to do these calls. I can only do a couple of them per week. So if you want to get your call, go sign up at wavebreak.co for it as soon as possible and we can talk about how we can work together. Thanks for listening to this episode. Subscribe to the show on iTunes to get notified of new episodes as soon as they drop.